Today we're going to continue in Genesis, moving into the story of Jacob and Rachel, which is a beautiful love story out of antiquity. Now, one of the things that makes this particular love story so unique is that it comes from a time when human love, romantic love, was not really considered a part of marriage. It was really Christ who came on the scene and, I don't want to say introduced that concept, but he created a religion, he created a faith in which human romantic love could flourish. Romantic love really doesn't particularly exist before Christianity. And even following Christianity, it was very slow to spread, particularly slowing with the spread of Christianity. Prior to this, marriage was a contract. It was a contract that was undertaken for financial reasons, for political reasons. It was a contract that would bring two tribes together in agreement. It was a contract that would provide income in the form of a dowry to a man who needed a wife. It was a contract that would be taken care of if a man lost his wife and he needed someone to care for the family. Men in antiquity would often be remarried before the wife was buried because of the need to have a woman care for the house. So it was so desperate in an agrarian society when the most advanced tool they had was a stone hoe. I mean, this was hard times. And a man could not make it alone. He could not tend his field and hunt and care for his children at the same time. But as in all rules, there are exceptions. And the story of Jacob and Rachel is a glowing exception, where romantic love becomes so celebrated and so pure. So as we recall from last week, Jacob was fleeing his brother Esau and going to his uncle Laban, Rebekah's brother, to meet a wife from the family tribe, from the family that gave birth to Abraham and Isaac, and now Jacob seeks his own wife. So we remember last week the story of the ladder and the angels and the promise that God made to Jacob, and that Jacob makes to God. And as he comes to Laban's territory, which the Bible refers to as Haran. I always keep calling it Akkad because that is what archaeologists now refer to that region as the region of Akkad. But in the Bible it's called Haran. And he comes to a well. Wells are very prominent throughout the Old Testament. He comes to a well and meets some individuals and he's asking, "Do you know Laban? You know Laban, he's my uncle." And they said, "Yes, we know him." And here comes his daughter with the sheep. Rachel was a shepherdess. You see, shepherds and shepherdesses get all kinds of good press in the Bible. It's not really true. It's not the way it is in the Middle East in real life. Shepherds and shepherdesses were treated or considered to be the lowest rung of society. But in the Bible, they're elevated to this this wonderful level because they reflect the care of God for his creatures. And the Bible has different ways of measuring things than the world does. So he meets Rachel and she immediately becomes his true love. It's love at first sight. He sees her and he assists her with the well. There's this big stone that's over the well. She's not strong enough to lift it, so Jacob lifts the stone for her so she can care for her flock. And then, as in all love stories. He kisses her. And after he kisses her, he starts to cry. It's in the Bible. I hope you've read it. It's this beautiful love at first sight, which you just don't find in ancient literature. It is just a wonderful expression of human love that comes to us from Genesis here. Which is why I put this reading for it. I always put out these readings in the New Testament, and sometimes I feel like it's obvious why, but it's not always obvious. But we see when St. Paul is writing, with the beauty of human love, you know, husbands must love their wives. Wives must respect their husbands. This only existed in the church. This is an expression of human love that was unique to the church and not to the society as a whole. So after this event, Jacob's crying and Rachel is just completely confused, and Laban comes up to greet his kinsman. Well, Jacob immediately starts working for Laban, starts helping him. He's being a good guest. He has been welcomed. He has been given water. And that's an important thing in Old Testament culture. And to this day, in desert nomadic cultures, if you invite someone into your tent and you give them water, you have a bond with them. So Laban has invited Jacob in, he's given him water, and Jacob becomes a good guest and he's helping care for his flocks. This goes on for about a month. And then Laban says, "You're my kinsman, you should not be working for me for nothing. What wage would you like?" And Jacob, in love, says, "All I want is your daughter Rachel." So Laban, realizing that he's got the poor kid over a barrel, says, "All right, work for me for free for 7 years, and I'll let you have Rachel." So that's quite a dowry. 7 years' wages. So this is what he did. And then the scripture says, and this is in chapter 20, verse 29, "They seemed but a few days because of the greatness of his love." That's what I said, 29:20. That's not what I said? Who knows what I said? That's why I was on the tape, though. It's dreadful I record these things. Because it gets all of my mistakes. I'm always saying things backwards. I hope you all can straighten it out in your head or correct me. That's fine. But at the end of 7 years, and most of you know the story, when Jacob is getting to marry Rachel, he's all excited, and he marries Laban's daughter, and the next morning he wakes up, and lo and behold, it is not Rachel. It is Leah, the ugly sister. In fact, the Bible says she's the ugly sister. Actually, what the Bible says is that she has weak eyes, which translates into our culture. It's an idiom, the ugly sister. And Jacob's very, very upset. But Laban says, "I cannot marry my younger daughter until I marry off the older daughter. And we made a deal for a daughter, and you got a daughter." But Laban still got him over a barrel. "If you work for me for another 7 years, then I'll let you have Rachel." But fortunately, Laban does not make Jacob wait 7 years to have Rachel. After a week, their honeymoon with Leah, he's allowed to marry Rachel, but Jacob is given the pledge to work for another 7 years. Well, during this time, Jacob starts having sons. Now, you all know that there are 12 tribes of Israel, so you know that eventually Jacob's going to wind up with 12 sons. He has 4 sons by Leah, but Rachel is barren. She cannot give him a son. So you remember the custom with Abraham and Hagar, the wife gives her servant to her husband. And so Jacob gets Rachel, Leah, and both of their handmaids, both of their female slaves. So he's doing okay for himself, and he starts to have more sons by the handmaids, by the servants of Rachel and Leah. And Rachel finally comes to Jacob and says, "It's all your fault that I can't get pregnant." And Jacob says, "Who am I, God? What do you expect?" So, but he prays for her, and she conceives and gives birth to Joseph, who is going to play a very important role later on, become one of the patriarchs. Now, at this point, Jacob has completed his 7 years for his second wife, for Rachel, but he is broke because he's been working this whole time for 14 years without wages. Well, all the time that Jacob is working for Laban, Laban is doing very well for himself. He is growing rich, whereas he never was before. His flocks are flourishing. His goats and his sheep are having lots of goats and sheep, and they're all healthy, and everything's doing well. And Laban perceives that the reason he is doing well is because God is with Jacob, that the blessing of God is on Jacob. So Laban really wants to keep Jacob around, but he's run out of daughters. So they contrive this plan, they contrive this agreement in which Jacob will continue to serve Laban for a while yet longer. And during this time, part of the flock will go to Jacob so that Jacob will have his own provision, his own sustenance, and not just everything belonging to Laban. Laban thinks he's shrewd. And they come up with the plan. Okay, Laban says, "I will take all of the normal sheep and all of the normal goats, and you get all the black sheep and the speckled goats." Now, to us that doesn't sound so odd, because we see lots of speckled goats, right? However, this is 4,000 years ago, and their livestock was much more akin to to wild sheep and wild goats, the mountain goats, which you would see, which are typically almost all a single color. I don't know if you spent much time chasing mountain goats, but if you ever do, you'll discover that they're almost all one color. They don't have speckled. That's something that has come out of domestication. But Jacob is a conniver. And that's kind of what his name means. He's kind of a conniver. And he decides that he knows how to create speckled goats and black sheep. And that is to take branches, and there are three particular types of trees. There's sycamore trees, and if I can't find it in my notes, I don't remember what they are, but there are three different kinds of trees that he takes these rods and branches, and he strips the bark in such a fashion as to make them striped. And he creates these stripes probably in like a chevron shape. And he lays these striped rods in the feeding trough so that when the sheep and the goats come to drink water, they will see these rods. And these rods will automatically make them put them in heat, and that then they will get pregnant looking at these striped rods. And looking at the striped rods while they are getting pregnant will make them produce striped and speckled offspring. Now, believe it or not, people have tried this. People who have wanted, you know, a lot of people really want to take the Bible very, very literally, and they see this and say, "Ah, it says that Jacob did this and it worked." But it doesn't work. It has whatever the sheep or goat is looking at has no bearing at all on the offspring. However, the grace of God does. And regardless of how strange a plan of animal husbandry that Jacob had in mind, it's really the grace of God that brings about this increase for Jacob. And Jacob begins, and suddenly all these sheep and goats that have always been one color are now coming out black and speckled and striped in all kinds of ways that is driving Laban crazy. And suddenly Laban is losing all of his flocks to Jacob. Jacob begins to perceive that Laban is after him. Before I go there, let me say one thing. There's a principle to be learned here. And like I say, throughout the scriptures, we pick up these principles of how God operates. And one of these key principles that we see at work here is that God cares for those who are oppressed. When people are wrongly mistreated, God cares. And when those who are wrongly treated, who are mistreated, remain faithful to God, then God is able to pour blessings into their lives. It is the principle that we see in Paul's letter to the Thessalonians. Give thanks in all circumstances. Whatever comes upon you, give thanks. Peter writes, rejoice when you are persecuted. Whatever comes upon you, rejoice. Remain faithful in those times when you are maliciously treated. Remain faithful to God. Don't get mad at God and blame God and run away from God, but stay faithful to God. Give Him thanks. Rejoice in the midst of suffering. And God is able to pour a blessing into you through that. So Laban, though he's being mistreated by Laban, remains faithful to God. And striped sycamore branches aside, God is able to bring blessing into him. But Laban is feeling tricked, and Jacob perceives that he is in trouble, that Laban is about to come after him. So he packs up in the night his wives and his children, his speckled and striped sheep and goats, and they hightail it. He's going back to Canaan. He ran away from Canaan to get away from Esau. Now he's run away from Makkah to get away from his uncle Laban. Laban wakes up one morning and realizes that Jacob is gone. Now it takes him probably a little while to figure this out, because Jacob is always gone anyway, you know, taking care of the sheep and the goats. He's not hanging around the camp all day. But at some point he figures it out and he starts pursuing Jacob. It takes him 3 days to catch up to him. And Laban hasn't come alone. He's brought the whole tribe with him to destroy Jacob, get his daughters and his sheep and his goats and his grandchildren back. But God warns Laban in a dream not to harm Jacob. So indeed, Laban comes and finds him and says, I was going to rough you up, but God told me not to. However, I must ask you, why did you take my household idols? Why you not only took my daughters and my grandchildren, and you've got all, you know, over half my flocks. Why did you have to take the household idols? Jacob says, I would never touch your household idols. And if you can, feel free to search the camp. If you find your idols anywhere in my camp, whoever has them will die. So he searches the camp and does not find the idols. The idols are there. Rachel has them. She has them hidden. She puts them under the saddle. She has a camel saddle. Hides the idols under the camel. She sets the saddle on top. She sits on that. And when the men come into her tent to search, she says, excuse me, I cannot get up. The way of women is upon me. You know what that means. So they don't want to. All right, we're not moving you. So they leave her put. They leave her be, and the idols remain hidden. Now, why did Rachel take the idols? For weeks, I've been promising to tell you where idolatry comes from. This is the passage I've been waiting for, so I can tell you where idolatry comes from. You know, when we talked about early worship, we talk about the temples built 10,000 BC, and there are no idols in those temples. Yet now, 2000 BC, we see idols everywhere. There are all these idols. So what are these idols? Well, in a world without writing, how do you lay claim to ancestral property? How do you prove this land is my land instead of somebody else's land? Well, what they used to do is that they would form a small statue of the ancestor who originally owned the land. And that land became deed to, or that idol, that statue became deed to the property of that particular ancestor, the particular person. So you could prove ownership of land or of anything else, for flocks, you know, you don't brand them, but you have the statue, the actual word for it is teraphim. You know, like there are seraphim and cherubim, which are angels, and there's teraphim, which is an earthly representation of an ancestor. And this ancestor gives you rights to own things. So obviously, as time goes on, you begin to collect more and more ancestors. Native Americans did something very similar. They would carve an image of an ancestor or the symbol of an ancestor onto a pole, and they would line them up. So there were totems, and they would have all of the images of their ancestors, so that this land is where all these ancestors lived, and their herds were cared for. This belongs to the tribe of this totem. So it was an ancient practice. However, at some point, ancestor worship began to creep in. People began worshiping their ancestors. We know that this is true as early as Neolithic Jericho, which is about 6,000 BC. So from 10,000 BC with the temples that have no idols, by 6,000 BC we begin to see the development of ancestor worship. By this point, 2000 BC, we see Abraham and Laban and the spread of these household idols. These household gods really are their ancestors that hold the title to their lands and flocks. And that's where idolatry comes from. And over time, these worship ancestors became larger gods, probably because the tribe kept growing, so you had enough people worshiping an ancestor that he became a big god. And if you read the annals of the Assyrian kings, which is not recommended reading, but if you read that, you will see that all these ancient Assyrian kings lived for 20 and 30,000 years, and they were like demigods. You know, they were worshipped as gods, these ancient kings. So this all became idolatry. So when Rachel's hiding these idols, it's not that she particularly wants to worship idols. It's that she wants her daddy's stuff. And this becomes a characteristic of Rachel. We begin to see this principle that God is teaching us in this passage. These two sisters, Leah and Rachel. Rachel is the beautiful sister, but she's got some issues. First place, she really likes stuff. And secondly, she's unfruitful. She can't have children. She does eventually, through the prayer of Jacob, have a child. And later she'll have a second. I'll mention that in just a second, but she's got issues. She's beautiful and she's loved, but she's got issues. She's really tied up in the things of this world. And then there's Leah. She's the ugly sister. But she's the fruitful one who continues to give Jacob sons. Now, the way this story ends, this is a few chapters down, but I'm going to bring it up because it applies to this. Is that Rachel finally does give birth to a second son. And in that birth, she dies. And it's happened at a place while they were traveling, and she's buried alongside the road. Leah, on the other hand, continues to serve as a faithful wife. And she is received into the tomb of her ancestors, the cave of Machpelah, with Abraham, Isaac, Sarah, Rebecca. Again, we see where God's perspective is different from the world's. Most people want to be the beautiful sister, the loved sister, the one that's cared for, the one that has the household idols hidden under her camel saddle. But God cared for Leah. It was God, not Laban, who ordained that Jacob should have her as a wife instead of Rachel. It was God who ordained that she would be fruitful. It was God who ordained that she would be faithful. And she was cared for to the end by God. Rachel loved much more, admired more by the world, but she missed something. She missed something. So it simply calls us to mind that success in the world, even the joy of the romance, is a far second to the fruitfulness that brings God's favor.